humans reveal certain details. So, for example, I learned when I was requesting information that involved with certain land defenders, and the government's argument for not releasing that information was that they realized that they had actually been collecting personal information on these land defenders illegally. And they successfully made that argument, but that little tidbit was in itself kind of an interesting story. Another example was I had FOI'd BC Wildfire Service's wildfire investigation report into the Lytton fire, and they had refused to release it. And again, the OIPC sided with the government, but in making their argument, the Ministry of Forests wrote that the wildfire expert who was analyzing the cause of the fire actually changed his mind at one point throughout his investigation. It's maybe not the transparency that BC residents would expect from their government, but it just goes to show that through perseverance, it may take several years, you might actually learn a little bit about your request, even if it's not the full records that you had hoped for.
Enter James Turk and the Code of Silence Award. This snarky little number is an award that's given each year to a publicly funded agency in the categories of federal government or government agency, provincial government or government agency, local government or municipality, and law enforcement. Anyone can nominate any agency within these categories, and the award is co-sponsored by the Center of Free Expression, the Canadian Association of Journalists, and Canadian Journalists for Free Expression. Nominations for 2024's Code of Silence winners deadline is December 31st, and I'm speaking to James Turk now about the creation and intent of this award.
I'm Jim Turk. I'm the director of the Center for Free Expression at Toronto Metropolitan University. The Center for Free Expression is for the public primarily, although it's based in a university. It's not university focused, it's publicly focused. And it grows out of understanding that democracy is founded on an ongoing public discourse about what's legitimate and what's not legitimate in society. It's a discourse that can never be brought to an end. That is, we elect a government, it is a majority government, it passes laws, we have to obey those laws, but we never lose our right in a genuine democracy to challenge them, to try to get a different government elected, to get them to reverse their views. And so that ongoing public discourse is really the core of democracy. And there are two things that are important for it to be as effective as possible. One is that everyone has a right to participate in it. And secondly, that should be a real right.
The Center for Free Expression also offers advocacy, intervention in court cases, research, public education, whistleblower protection, and they work with provinces to introduce anti-SLAPP legislation, which is strategic lawsuits against public participation. In British Columbia, environmental groups, activists, and journalists are regularly threatened with SLAPP suits for challenging projects such as pipelines, mines, and fish farms. BC's NDP government passed Canada's original anti-SLAPP law in 2001, but after the party was ousted from government later that year, the BC Liberals overturned the legislation. Then in 2019, BC's legislature unanimously passed the Protection of Public Participation Act, which aims to allow journalists to argue that they are speaking out in a matter of public importance and that the harm in allowing a lawsuit to go ahead outweighs the benefits to the public, resulting in the strongest anti-SLAPP legislation in any jurisdiction in the world. So the Center of Free Expression wanted to bring attention to Canada's access to information legislation in a unique way.
We published an article a few years ago that was titled 206 Recommendations for Changing Canada's Access to Information Legislation. And what it was just the recommendations that had come out of innumerable royal commissions, parliamentary committees, individual task forces, and so on, that had been set up to make recommendations around Canada's access to information legislation. Almost none of them ever implemented. And it was in that context that we decided to draw some public attention to this in a humorous way. So we created this award, the Code of Silence Award, for outstanding achievement in government secrecy.
What has been the effect of giving a publicly funded organization a dubious award? Have you seen change happen because of the Code of Silence Award?
The biggest response we've gotten historically has been the municipality or the municipal agency that's been named the most secretive in Canada that year. And so I've had irate mayors calling me. These awards have become the subject of city council meetings or municipal council meetings. Many of them are very upset, and quite a number of them have engaged in very egregious secretive practices. And one of the impacts has been, at that level, change in the behavior of some of those municipalities and getting away from their overly secretive approaches to things. The nominations almost always come from either journalists or members of the public who've used the access to information legislation to make a request for information that should be available to the public.
Yeah.
Have been refused, or they get the document and 90% of it is blacked out, or they are told that, yes, you can have the document, but it's going to cost you $8,000. Or the most egregious case was a request to the RCMP for information about a campaign or an initiative they had run in, I think, from 2010 to 2012. And the response back was, yes, we'll provide it to you, but it's going to take 292,000 days to do it, which is 800 years.
Oh my gosh.
And that got appealed and it got reduced to 80 years. Now, I mean, that's ludicrous. This was about a campaign during an era when we actually have digital records. Anyways, so, I mean, that is just beyond the pale. But often people, I was just talking with a journalist now who proudly sent me a request that he and I had put together 7 years ago. It just came. Right. So we look at those kinds of things where there clearly is using the legislation to obstruct a genuine access.
Here's the Narwhal's Northwest BC reporter, Matt Simmons.
I recently got back a couple of requests from the RCMP that I originally filed in March 2022. So that's a 2.5 year wait, which is pretty long, obviously, and well past the legislated deadline. And from what I understand with the RCMP, that's actually pretty decent, which is frustrating to say the least. One of those requests was 100% redacted, so I'm not even sure how many pages were in there, but they did not provide me with any of the records that I requested, so that's also a little bit frustrating. The other one was extremely heavily redacted to the point of being virtually unusable. The RCMP, you know, it's pretty widely known that they're not great at being responsive. They regularly overshoot deadlines and are particularly heavy in their redactions. I had a conversation with an analyst at one point about it, and I was told that some of the redactions that are regularly applied on police files are very discretionary. So I think it's Section 16 of the Federal Act is around disclosure of information that would be harmful to police business, and that's sufficiently vague that it can be applied to, well, we don't actually know because, of course, we don't get those records. But I tried to push back on redactions saying, you know, it's a matter of public interest, which applies under the Act. And I had that conversation that basically said they can use their discretion. So the RCMP can say, well, it is, and we can't tell you why it is harmful to police business, and there's no real recourse. So that's definitely frustration, especially when we're talking about matters of public interest that are occurring in real time.
So which public organizations are easier to work with?
The BC Energy Regulator is surprisingly extremely easy to work with on freedom of information requests, in my experience. They're kind of this standalone department of government, and they kind of have an in-house freedom of information process. So unlike the rest of the BC government, you don't have to pay. The rest of the BC government, you have to pay $10 a pop for a Freedom of Information request, and sometimes fees on top of that. The BC Energy Regulator is free, and you go directly to them. They're really responsive, and they, from my experience, they don't seem to redact as much information, at least not on the requests that I've been filing with them. So I encourage everyone to go file Freedom of Information requests with the BC Energy Regulator, and I'll be watching those proactive disclosure sites to see what comes up. I think Canada, both the federal government and provinces and territories, I mean, I speak from my perspective with province of BC, should do a heck of a lot more proactive disclosure. I think the principles of a democratically elected government is it's working for the people. And when there's so much that is not disclosed, there's this lack of transparency, and journalists have to fight tooth and nail to get that information, I think that undermines the public confidence in the process of democracy itself. And that's really problematic.
Proactive discourse in Canada is the practice of releasing information to the public before it's requested. It's a key part of open government, and is intended to improve accountability and transparency, as well as encourage more informed public debate.
The more we have distrust of the government, whether it's founded, you know, on actual examples of the government being untrustworthy, or in these cases of lack of transparency and this, you know, struggle to get information that should be publicly available, that seeds distrust. And I think that should be changed.
As journalists, too, we're so often not allowed to, like, make the story, right? We have to document events and reactions to events. But is the Code of Silence Award, is it kind of a way to empower journalists and the public to let them tell the story?
Well, it's a way to let the public know in a concrete way some of the problems with our access to information legislation. But it was just a way of speaking not abstractly about the difficulties of our access to information legislation, but giving really concrete examples of how it's failing. Under the access to information legislation in every province and also federally, there are certain things that are excluded. There are certain agencies. So under the federal legislation, the Canada Blood Services Agency, you cannot ask for information from them. In other words, the way it works in most countries is all federal agencies are included except for those that are specifically excluded. The federal government, but all agencies and boards and commissions of the federal government are only included if they're listed on the legislation. So the default is they're not included. So that's a problem. But we don't give awards based on problems in the legislation. We give awards where someone is to be covered, the information being asked for is not excluded, and they still don't get it.
Here's Amanda again, speaking to what changes she as a journalist would like to see happen moving forward with legislation around FOI requests.
I would really like to see governments dedicating more resources to the freedom of information process. Delays and extensions have just become a matter of course over the last few years. It just feels like an act of frustration for everybody involved. You file a request, you know that you're going to be waiting months, if not years, to get the information that you're looking for. And it feels like increasingly there's a backlog of complaints waiting to be heard around FOI requests. If governments would adequately fund this process on the front end and move these requests through faster, they wouldn't be dealing with a backlog of complaints. And I think it would lead to better transparency and more trust in government all around.
Okay, so what can the public and journalists do that's maybe you've learned from this award that makes it easier for them to access public information? Here's James Turk again.
Well, I had a whole bunch of things I used to recommend, but then the Toronto Globe and Mail launched what it calls the Secret Canada Project, The editor-in-chief, David Walmsley, assigned two of his senior reporters, Robin Doolittle and Tom Cardosa, to start reporting in every story they do where it's relevant, issues related to the problems they face in getting information for the story from the federal government or from provincial governments. And then he appointed a number of staff at the Globe to prepare a back end to this project where they would have a database of hundreds of thousands of access to information requests that had been made, because once you've made an access to information request, that information is then publicly available. But they also created a database of all the public agencies in Canada that are covered by access to information legislation. So if you're interested in getting information from a particular agency, BC Hydro or whomever, you can just go into the Secret Canada database on the Globe and Mail website, click on the agency you want. It tells you who the contact person is, their email address, and then they have a resource for all of us there where you click on it and it actually helps write the letter.
Yeah.
So that's what I recommend to anybody who wanted to file an information request to go there first.
Yeah. What's the feedback that you tend to hear about this award from both people that you work with, but then also when people find out about it, what's typically their reaction?
Well, I wish it were better known across Canada. So we do hear from journalists quite frequently who, in addition to nominating people, also follow the results of it and say, oh, yeah, I had trouble with that municipality as well, or whatever. We hear that sort of thing. I also hear, especially in the municipal category, from outraged mayors or city councilors saying, how dare you name our community? And we say, well, here are the facts. You know, there was a request made to you for this information. You told people they couldn't have it, and you gave them a bogus reason.
Yeah.
And it was really important information for that community to have. But that's outrageous, blah, blah, blah. So we also hear from some of the recipients.
Yeah. James also wanted to encourage journalists and members of the public to stay vigilant with governments and agencies and to submit a nomination form online if you think that you have a good case for a winner of the Code of Silence Award. In order to do that, go to cfe.torontomu.ca, or you can simply just Google Center for Free Expression Code of Silence Award.
So if anyone has sought information from a public body and in your mind or their mind been inappropriately denied it or delayed in getting it, or what you got had most of the interesting stuff redacted or blacked out, you can nominate that agency very easily by going to the Center for Free Expression website. And there's a link there to the nomination form. It's just a Google form, and you just put the information into that, and it goes into the hopper then.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and explaining this award in detail.
Well, it's very kind of you to be interested. I'm really delighted. I hope some of your listeners will actually make submissions.
Yeah, I think so too.
I hope others will check out the Globe and Mail Secret Canada site, because it's probably the most exciting thing that's been done to help bring about better access to information legislation in Canada than we've seen in 30 years.
Thanks again for tuning in to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at skeenastrong.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks again to our producer, Pam Hassan, and all of our roving reporters. I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.
New Westminster's Thomas Out Aquatic and Community Center is turning heads and winning awards. The state-of-the-art facility, whose name Thomas Out is the Hunkamina word for sea otter house, has achieved a RHF Accessibility Certified Gold rating under the Rick Hansen Foundation's Accessibility Certification Program, and won the Prix Versailles 2024 World Title Special Prize for an Interior in the sports category. The Prix Versailles is an award based on a review of architectural media from around the world, highlighting the most discussed projects within the architecture community. Paul Fast, principal architect for the firm HCMA, which designed the Thomas Out Aquatic and Community Center, explains why Tumasout was selected as the 2024 winner.
Well, the project has achieved a number of notable firsts, which has really helped elevate it to a fairly prominent position in the media over the past few months. And so it's the first all-electric aquatic center of its kind, which is a whole new way of thinking about this typology of building. It's the first zero-carbon design aquatic facility in Canada. It achieved incredibly high standards for accessibility and inclusion through a number of design interventions. And so I think all of these things in combination really created a project that grabbed people's attention. And so it's been featured quite extensively in the media. And people are paying attention because they're looking for projects that are sort of defining what the future is of this building type in the design world.
As a public, community-oriented facility, the Tumasout Aquatic and Community Center sticks out from its competition, including large-scale projects like the Olympic Aquatic Center in Saint-Denis, France, and Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, home of the National Football League's New England Patriots.
I think it's a fantastic validation of the importance of this building type in sports architecture. Most awards programs, when they focus on sports buildings, tend to focus on the really large kind of mega projects and stadiums. And of course, those have their own kind of impact. But we know that recreation is incredibly important to communities, to the everyday life of people here in our country. And we know that these buildings play a crucial role in the kind of social fabric of communities. And so for this building to be recognized amongst those other really large scale projects is really satisfying and rewarding.
The building is also notable for its use of and relationship to the surrounding landscape, which FAST says is a great example of architecture that works with the land instead of against it.
It's actually one of my favorite parts of the whole story of the building, because if you look back at the original condition of that site, sort of pre-settlement or pre-contact, there was a ravine there which we named Glenbrook Ravine. And that ravine was a natural feature that had an ecology around it. The First Nations used it for various things. It was over, as settlement occurred, they put a 2-meter sewer line down the bottom of it and then backfilled it with all sorts of junk. And it really became kind of a symbol of the way in which we work against the land rather than with it. So one of the first steps for our building design process was to actually say, let's bring back the memory of that ravine because it was important and it was lost and it's worth recognizing. So rather than take the building and orient the building to the street grid, we said, let's turn the whole building so it faces the ravine. And it essentially, we're saying that the most important thing for this building is to interact with the memory of that ravine. And so we created this large public green space that is essentially the reincarnation at a surface level of that ravine landscape, and made all of the building windows face into it, all of the kind of key building alignments, circulation pathways feed into that kind of green space. And so some of the things we're learning from our Indigenous friends is that the principles around how you build with land as opposed to against it, that was one of the key moments. It also allowed us to, one of the other funny things about the street grid in New Westminster is it doesn't face perfectly north. And so if you build a building that aligns with the street grid, it will not face perfectly north. It faces about a 45-degree angle off. That becomes really important for a pool, because how you bring light into a pool is really important. You need to control it for glare and for lifeguarding safety, all those things. And so not only aligning the building with the ravine not only gave us a powerful connection to the landscape, but it brought in a north-facing light that was really comfortable and safe and really pleasant for people in swimming in the pool. So those are some of the strategies we used then when we say working with the land as opposed to against it.
A key reason for the city's Prix Versailles title is the focus on accessibility, which was also recognized through its achievement of an RHF Accessibility Certified Gold rating from the Rick Hansen Foundation's Accessibility Certification Program. Mayor Patrick Johnstone says the building, which is the City of New Westminster's largest capital project to date, was designed for people of all ages and abilities from the ground up, with accessibility in mind.
The city took an intentional approach to accessibility in this building. When we were doing the design work and the planning work with the community 5-6 years ago, the accessibility community talked about the importance of including accessibility at the design phase. Quite often you will build a building like this, you'll design a building, and then you will add on the accessibility elements to make sure that everyone has access to it. But we were intentional in starting right at the beginning with the design and having the accessibility community tell us what accessibility meant to them and giving that to the designers, but then also including professionals who could bring an accessibility lens to every step of the design. So when it was still lines on paper, they could walk through that and actually look at the accessibility barriers and the challenges that we were creating before we created them. And the goal was, obviously, to get as close to universal accessibility as we could, but also to not have to tack things off after, to actually make it integrated into design so we save money and save time and start on the right step.
Centering accessibility and making it a key part of the aquatic and community center's design is representative of the city's overall accessibility strategy, which includes in-depth community consultation and the consideration of intersecting and often contradicting accessibility needs.
Universal accessibility is the goal. It's very difficult to achieve because quite often if you design for some forms of accessibility to remove some barriers, you end up creating barriers for other forms. Things like creating very bright and vibrant color fabrics for wayfinding and such is great for people who might have visual disabilities, but it might also be a problem for people who have neurodiversity issues and may find too much sensory input, making it confusing for them to navigate a space. Mm-hmm. You try to design so that you can address both of those as best as you can and try to find the balance in that space. Some of the accessibility elements you can't add afterwards. There are things like the zero-step entry for the recreation pool that you just can't design in afterwards. It also took us a creative approach to address accessibility in the competition pool because you can't have a sloped entry into a competition pool, so we had to find another alternative that worked with the modern competition pool designs.
Brad McCannell is the Vice President of Access and Inclusion at the Rick Hansen Foundation.
There's all kinds of things the RHFAC professional will be looking for. But the other thing to recognize is that every site's different. Everybody's got a different goal in mind. The level of access provided depends on the occupancy on the site and the use of the building. So the assessor will come in and start looking for, certainly you have to meet code, you have to meet regulations, there's no doubt about that. How did you go above and beyond that?
McCannell explains that beyond providing ratings so that potential users can understand how accessible a given building might be, the Rick Hansen Foundation Accessibility Certification Program aims to shift the conversation around accessibility.
This is a cultural shift that we're looking for. This is trying to get everybody, the owner, the operator, the architect, the planner, the people swinging the hammers, to understand the old model, which is building a house or a building for 18 to 55-year-old males. That old model is not doing anybody any good because the moment you put up a building, it needs to be retrofitted. So that's killing your budgets, it's killing your sustainability rating, because I go in there and I tear everything out and drywall goes to the landfill. Understanding that what the RHFAC is actually doing is shifting culture, it's training architects, it's exposing them to ideas they haven't seen before, and most importantly, it's exposing them to the return on investment that's available.
Part of the reason for the Tummasout Aquatic and Community Center's success at achieving accessibility is that accessibility was a key focus from the beginning of the design process, instead of attempting to retrofit solutions once the center had already been built.
One of our real goals, part of the culture shift, is to move accessibility, move universal design, the practical application of universal design, to move that into the normal, everyday design process. This is where the victories are. You look at sustainability, for example. In the 70s, sustainability was just an academic discussion around the table. But by the new millennium, the LEED program for sustainability had moved that into common everyday building process. And they did that by simple education, by having a course offered to professionals in the field that could be recognized as their normal professional development. And it brought them along, helped them understand the real issues around sustainability. They were able to take that concept, and instead of it being something you add at the end of a project, they had people, because it was part of their normal professional development, they brought sustainability to the water cooler, to the carpool, to the lunchroom. And that's what we were able to do with the RHFAC program, by having professionals take the courses, get the accreditation. All of a sudden now it's part of the discussion everywhere. It's not something you add after the fact, like it's landscaping. The thing about aging-in-place solutions, the thing about the practical application of universal design, it can affect everything if you let it. And so having it part of the process, the normal design process, not something separate, not something you do after, like it's landscaping, that's a really critical piece of the whole concept.
McCannell says that this kind of accessibility-centered design is hugely important and benefits everyone, whether disabled or able-bodied.
Able-bodied people, we call you TABS. See, we got names for you too. We call you TABS because you're only temporarily able-bodied. Doesn't matter if you do a face plant when you're a teenager and you end up in a wheelchair, or you're 75 and you need a walker and a hearing aid, you will be part of our community sooner or later. the largest minority group in the world and the only one that anyone can join at any moment. Fall down the stairs, an illness, a car accident, maybe you just get old. You're going to be part of this community. It's not us and them. It's just us. This is about me. It's about you. It's about your mom.
From the Thomasout Aquatic and Community Center in New Westminster, I'm Jesse Wensloff for CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, reporting. This piece was made possible with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can find this piece online at frequencynews.ca.
The staff